From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump is promising to tout the strength of the economy and people who love and hate our country in a campaign rally in North Carolina tonight, his first since his racist tweet Sunday that four Democratic congresswomen of color should go back to their countries, even though they're all American, three born here.
Last night, just four Republicans joined Democrats in passing a resolution condemning those tweets. So let's bring in our political strategist, Bill Press, Democratic strategist. Hi, Bill.
Hello, hello.
And Alice Stewart, Republican strategist. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Jeremy. Hi, Robin.
Hi.
Okay, so most people, Alice, agree that it is racist to tell someone to go back to the country that they came from, even though in this case, as Robin just said, three of the four were born in the U.S. This is from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission fact sheet on the rights of immigrants under federal anti-discrimination laws. Examples of potentially unlawful conduct include insults, taunting, or ethnic epithets, such as making fun of a person's foreign accent or comments like, quote, go back to where you came from, whether made by supervisors or by coworkers. That would be illegal in the workplace. Why are Republicans so afraid, Alice, to call out President Trump on this?
Because those that have called out the president previously have faced primary challenges and it comes back to haunt them. But let's unpack this a little bit. The words he used, clearly inappropriate. They were wrong. It was insulting, but
were they racist?
I do give him the benefit of the doubt with regard to the purpose of what he was saying. And Liz Cheney said it best yesterday. She said his comments were not about the color of the four congresswomen's skin. It was not about their race. It was not about their gender. The comments were about their overall socialist policies when it comes to being anti-Semitic, when it comes to a lot of comments they have made about religion and about America and about pro-life issues and about late-term abortion. Those are the kinds of issues that the president has had a problem with. That is what he was going after. He said it in an inartful way, but that is the point that he was trying to make.
Bill, I have to let you in on this one. Go for it.
Well, first of all, breaking news. I'm not one, but it is okay to be a socialist in the United States of America. And not be condemned and not be told to go back where you came from. Look, I'm tired of playing games with this, right? These comments were disgusting. They were racist comments. You know, I'm tired of people saying Donald Trump is not a racist. He's just a man who says some racist things. This was a racist comment against people of color. I grew up in a segregated town in Delaware, and I remember as a kid hearing people say to black people, and they didn't call them that, they called them something else, and you know what I'm talking about, go back where you came from. I thought we'd made a lot of progress in this country. I never thought I would hear those words coming from the president of the United States. And I think we're left in a situation today where the fact is we have a racist in the White House. He was a racist as a businessman, as a candidate, ran a racist campaign as president. And that's a fact, and it's up to the American people to decide. Are we better than that or not? And we'll have a chance in 2020.
Alice, I have to ask you, are you saying that if someone is for abortion rights, let's say, or for Medicare for All, which countries that are democratically socialist have more government involvement in medical care, it's okay for the president of the United States to tell them they should go back to their country of origin?
No, Robin, I'm not. I'm talking about the overall unified policy what we have of the four women in the squad.
But that's what it sounds like. If somebody's policy, if you disagree with somebody's policy, that's what government's about. It's okay to kick them out of the country?
That is not okay. And that is not where we should be in this country. The point was, and that I hope Republicans will continue to make, it is the overall comprehensive policy of the four of them. As I said, Green New Deal, late-term abortion, socialist policies, anti-Semitic comments that they have not been called out for adequately.
All four of them? Or are you just talking about Ilhan Omar?
I'm talking about the comprehensive group. And if you remember, it was just last week where Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez was going after Nancy Pelosi for what she called the, quote, explicit singling out of newly elected women of color. So she had this argument last week with Nancy Pelosi. She's got it this week with President Trump. And this is something I would like to think we would get past the name-calling and the racial aspect of this and look at it for what it is. This is on policy.
If I may, the way to get past this is for Republicans to get some backbone, for Republicans to stand up and say, this is wrong, Mr. President. We're with you on your policies. This is wrong. Now cut it out.
But Bill, let me ask you, if I can
just make one other point. I remember those 16 candidates on stage in the Republican primary, including Ted Cruz, Alice was working for. Not one of those candidates would have made a comment like this. They would not have made it, and if they did make it, they would not have gotten away from it. It's time to stop coddling the racist Donald Trump. It's the only way to get beyond this.
Bill, look, I just have to ask you, though, about something that Alice just brought up. And, Alice, you tweeted it out today.
I did.
Well, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's own words, and a lot of Republicans are citing these words, saying it's the Democrats who are racist, because after that Democratic infighting over the immigration bill, Ocasio-Cortez said Speaker Pelosi is explicitly singling out newly elected women of color. Is that infighting on the Democratic side opening the door for Republicans to make this claim that it's the Democrats who first attacked the four?
No. I hear that all the time. Right. I see that written all the time. I think it's silly. Look, first of all, she did say that. She immediately followed up and said, no, I was not suggesting at all in any way that Nancy Pelosi is a racist. She also said that, Robin. Mm-hmm. And she pointed out, I think the speaker pointed out correctly, that the squad, the four of them, made so much noise and they opposed that bill that provided more support to the border, which was the moderates wanted and the progressives did not. And Nancy pointed out, that's great, but there are only four of them and they had four votes and they got nobody else to vote with them. So she was just pointing out that their political power in the Congress is not that great.
Well, I think
that's a fair point. It's not a racist point at all. It's numbers.
Well, it's changed significantly because now the squad is virtually in control of the Democratic Party.
Oh, Alice, that's crazy.
They're all behind her. And I'll say this.
Tell Nancy Pelosi that.
This was a miscalculation on the part of this conversation we're having, because it was last week, it was just a few days ago, there was tremendous infighting in the Democratic Party. Now they are unified against President Trump. It will be interesting to see how this plays out, but you can't deny that there is racism. Thank you, Donald Trump. On that point,
Bill, is Trump getting what he wants right now by having us for the last many days, everybody, talking about these tweets and the reaction to them, and putting forward four of the most liberal members of the Democratic Party as for many right now the face of the party, or the whole party is having to come and defend them? Is this exactly what Trump wants?
In a one word answer, yes. He knows exactly what he's doing. This is a deliberate strategy. He is building. Look, he's going to a campaign rally tonight. He is building his campaign for 2020, which is all about going to be divide, divide, divide. And it worked in 2016. I'd like to point out it did not work in 2018 when it was caravan, 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 right? That was the whole thing to instill fear. Now it's squad, it's AOC or whatever.
But
that is his strategy,
yep.
And he thinks it's going to work. I don't think it will.
But it is so far, because I just want to, in the couple minutes we haven't been paying attention to the Democratic 2020 candidates and their health care bills, trying to differentiate themselves, Biden, Kamala Harris, Bernie Sanders. And the Jeffrey Epstein story has been wiped from the Etch-a-Sketch. And MSNBC host Mika Brzezinski reported this morning about an NBC video from 1992, a Donald Trump partying with the now, you know, the sex offender, but newly accused of sex trafficking, Jeffrey Epstein. And they're appearing to talk about women. Let's listen.
Trump gestures to one and appears to say to Epstein, look at her back there. She's hot. And then Trump says something else into Epstein's ear that makes him double over with laughter.
Alice, as a Republican strategist, are you worried that this story isn't going away?
If it does, it will be certainly troubling what Epstein has done and gotten away with.
I'm talking about Donald Trump's friendship with him.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it will certainly be troubling. What Epstein's done is disgusting and despicable. I'd like to think that there is no more to it than that video right there. But, you know, this is something we need to make sure and address Epstein for what happened to him, what he did, making sure that justice is done on him this time and he serves the time that he should serve, which is the rest of his life behind bars. That should be the focus more than anything, is making sure that justice is served.
Okay. In just the 30 seconds we have left, Bill, we've got a Democratic debate, the next one coming up in about 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. We spoke actually today on the show with Cory Booker, who's down around 1 or 2% in the polls right now.
Right.
But he's saying, look, this is very early. Do you agree with that? Is it for all the candidates who are really low in the polls right now, is it too early to say that that matters?
It is very early. He's right about that. But it's also true that there are now, if you want, the big five, right? I mean, it's Joe Biden, it's Bernie Sanders, it's Elizabeth Warren, it's Kamala Harris, and Pete Buttigieg. Mm-hmm. Even though it's early, it's going to be very hard for any one of those candidates who are good people, Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar,
O'Rourke,
or
right.
Kirsten Gillibrand, whatever, to break yep. through, because they won't have the resources to put troops on
go.
The ground.
Yeah. Bill Press, the Democratic strategist, Alice Stewart, the Republican, thank you so much.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
When it comes to health, there are a lot of myths. Put on your coat or you'll catch a cold. Cracking your knuckles causes arthritis. Caffeine stunts your growth. But none of them are true. And it turns out a lot of conventional medical wisdom isn't right either. In fact, there are at least 400 common medical practices that are completely contradicted by published peer-reviewed scientific studies. New York Times science reporter Gina Colata writes about these in her recent article, 10 Findings That Contradict Medical Wisdom, Doctors Take Note. She joins us now. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's so good to be back on the show.
And tell us, first of all, there are actually studies that show that the studies, the previous studies, are not true.
Right. What these researchers did is they said, well, you know, when we train in medicine, we read all these textbooks, and everything seems to fall in place in a very logical way. Like, for example, people who eat a lot of fish seem to have fewer heart attacks. And fish oil seems to have antioxidants. So therefore, everything is falling into place beautifully. So they publish a study saying fish oil has got to be protective against heart disease. And then somebody says, well, let's do a study and we'll give people fish oil or not fish oil and see what happens. And guess what? It doesn't make a difference if you give the typical supplement.
This was so painful to read that, you know, and as you said, it does make sense because fatty fish has omega-3 fatty acids. Supplements of omega-3, lower levels of triglycerides, high levels of triglycerides are linked to increased risk of heart disease. Therefore, if you take the supplements, you should have less risk of heart disease, but no.
Well, you know, that's what really instigated this study. The researchers said, well, there's all these blind alleys and missteps in medicine. And you think everything seems to be logical progression, and here is the answer. But then sometimes things that seem totally logical really aren't true anyway. Yeah. And there's millions of examples. People started writing to me saying, why didn't you include this? Why didn't you include that? And I said, you know what? I was writing about a paper that was published in a journal called eLife. And what they did was they took 3 major medical journals, took several years of their publications and said, we're going to look for clinical trials where people were randomly assigned to one thing or another that contradicted conventional medical wisdom. So they didn't take the whole universe. And yes, there are a lot of other things that were not in there, but that just sort of shows once again all these things that fooled people for so many years. I mean, I still remember the beta carotene study years ago. Everything worked, even in animals are protective against cancer. Everything was perfect. And then they did a clinical trial in people who were smokers at high risk of lung cancer. Guess what? Those who took beta carotene had more lung cancer. They stopped the trial.
It's so disheartening. Well, here's some more. Ginkgo biloba does not protect against memory loss and dementia, despite $249 million in sales of those supplements. So ginkgo biloba, no protection against memory loss. It was always thought that if teenage girls were forced to carry around a lifelike doll, they would not get pregnant because they would understand the responsibility. Actually, the girls carrying around the dolls had more pregnancies.
I fell for that one. You know, I thought that made so much sense, right? When you read about these girls carrying around the dolls, you think, okay, now you get it. If you ever had a baby, you know what it's like. But no, now they want babies. It was too much.
So, oops, that one didn't work. Step counters and calorie trackers don't help you lose weight. I'm taking mine off immediately. In fact, the people who, you know, wear the Fitbits and such, they actually lost less weight than those who just followed good advice.
They probably felt so virtuous that they thought they could then eat the next thing.
Well, that's, you know, we're reading currently in the paper that, you know, more exercise might actually make people eat more. They psychologically feel like, well, I'm exercising more so I can eat more, and then they don't lose any weight. If a pregnant woman's water breaks prematurely, the thinking was that baby has to be delivered immediately. And you see it all the time in the, you know, movies. There's the shot of the woman's feet. There's the water. Rush her to the hospital. Right. Deliver the baby. But the baby does not have to be delivered immediately.
That was so surprising because you would think, okay, now the sterile environment is breached, right? The baby's going to get an infection. No. Now, that doesn't apply, apparently, if you are really at your term. Mm. You know, it's really, it's due. It's time. You don't say, well, let's just wait a few more weeks. But if you're like, you know, a week or 2 weeks ahead of the term, you can wait. Yeah. And it's better for the baby.
Newborns left to gestate are healthier, so leave them there to keep growing. They have a lower risk of death, fewer respiratory distresses than those who are rushed into the world in delivery.
Right.
Here's one that actually the Times began reporting on this very early on. It's about torn meniscus. And I remember when the first Times report came out saying that the thinking was, if you have a torn meniscus, get it fixed. But the Times reported, based on a lot of research at that time, and this was a few years ago, no, especially after a certain age. And I guess this is one of the conclusions. Torn knee meniscus, try physical therapy first, surgery later.
Well, you know, it always seems like surgery should be a last resort on some of these things. I mean, surgery is so drastic. And surgery, if you actually remove part of the meniscus, that causes arthritis later. Actually, not that much later. So, you know, it's kind of scary. I like the physical therapy idea.
Well, where were you when I had my meniscus surgery? A little late for some of us. To protect against asthma attacks, it was thought you have to keep your house dust-free, no mites, mice, cockroaches. But?
Well, they had this thing called integrated pest management. Mostly supposed to get rid of mice. Now, you want to get rid of mice anyway. Yeah, I mean, who wants mice running around your house? But people who had this special program that was supposed to really clean your house, they had just as much asthma as people who didn't have it. And I guess, you know, asthma, like everything else, is so much more complicated than we think.
Yeah. Emergency rooms. This one was so disturbing given the opioid crisis. To treat emergency room patients in acute pain, a single dose of oral opioids is no better than aspirin and ibuprofen.
The only problem with that is that I found out later that that study was criticized because they said, well, the opioid dose wasn't high enough and the ibuprofen dose was really high. So maybe there is an argument about the doses. But on the other hand, if these are standard doses, then why do you want to give somebody an opioid?
Right.
I mean, really.
When you don't have to, and an ibuprofen will do just as well. Peanut allergies, they occur whether or not a child is exposed to peanuts before age 3. What thinking is that upsetting?
Well, people used to think that while the child's immune system is developing, if they're exposed to peanuts and they have a tendency to get a peanut allergy, then they're set for life, they're allergic to peanuts. Now it turns out that not only is that not true, but there's some clinical trials with, it's been essentially like peanut dust, and you sort of take it in a capsule, mm-hmm. and you give it to kids when they're really young, and they say that prevents the allergies. It doesn't cause them to give them peanuts.
Well, and as it turns out, children exposed to peanuts before they're even 1 year old have no greater risk of peanut allergies. One last one, testosterone treatment does not help older men retain their memory. You know, you say the Gina Colada that you heard from a lot of people saying, but there's this one, this one, this one. There's so many more, and hopefully you'll do another column. But were there also people just really resisting?
Mostly I had people saying it's about time, and people believe all sorts of stuff. But then again, the people that write to me may not be the general public. I had some people saying, you are a total idiot, and here's this fake news, and blah, blah, blah. And then I would always say, and they thought I made things up, and I said, you know, I always politely respond. I'll say, I'm so sorry you feel that way. I did link to the original study, and you might want to take a look at what it said, and you may not disagree when you see the actual paper that reported on the papers that contradicted the conventional wisdom. But mostly people were, oh, well, good. I'm so glad you wrote that.
And I just spent a good deal of time, you know, throwing out fish oil supplements. by the way, does that mean that fish itself isn't protective against heart disease?
You know, the whole diet thing is so hard to know what's true and what's not true. So people keep saying, well, people who eat fish, it's really good for you, and it probably is really good for you. But there's so many differences between people who eat fish and people who don't. There's differences between people who take a pill, even a sugar pill, every day and people who don't. I remember that came up with the Women's Health Initiative, where they were asking, do these hormones at menopause, estrogen and progestin, protect against heart disease and death? And every study seemed to say, look at this. The women who are taking Prempro, that was the drug, they live longer, they're healthier, everything is better, their memories are better, everything. So therefore, if we look at these big studies of populations, Prempro is really protective. And then they did a clinical trial, and it was not exactly protective. In fact, for some conditions, it was worse than taking a placebo. So the National Women's Health Network got up at an FDA meeting and said, well, what we learned is that anybody who takes anything every day, like a sugar pill, anything, they're generally a healthier person than someone who doesn't, because they care enough to actually do it every single day. So it could be, you know, the people who eat fish once a week, they just care enough to eat fish once a week, and they're just going to be healthier. So it's really hard with diets to know.
That's so amazing. New York Times reporter Gina Colada will link you to her article, 10 Findings That Contradict Medical Wisdom, Take Note, at hereandnow.org. Gina, thanks as always.
Thank you. It was really a pleasure talking to you. Thanks again.
Boeing announced today that it will dedicate half of its $100 million fund for families of victims in the crashes of two 737 MAX planes to provide what it calls near-term relief for those families. Meanwhile, the 737 MAX is still grounded. There are new problems, and it will be months at least before the planes can fly again. For more, let's bring in Seth Kaplan, here now transportation analyst. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
Okay, let's first talk about this victims fund. Boeing had already set aside $100 million to compensate families of the victims. It looks like they're now speeding that up. Why?
They're trying to get ahead of this to the extent they can. Boeing was criticized in the initial days and weeks after that second MAX crash for really being behind, not being at all proactive, sort of long after the world had decided that Boeing was at least largely at fault here. Boeing really wasn't admitting that. That might have been a sound legal strategy, Jeremy, to not admit fault, mm-hmm. but it was a terrible public relations strategy. And so I think now you have Boeing realizing that, look, it's going to be on the hook for some compensation one way or the other. Might as well, to the extent possible, be proactive. On a day today, Boeing, when you have families of the victims of the Ethiopians crash testifying on Capitol Hill, mm-hmm. one man who lost nearly his entire family.
Well, when the crashes happened and Boeing grounded the 737 MAX, all of their statements seemed to indicate that they were going to get them back flying again pretty soon, maybe over the summer. Now it's delayed until at least the fall, maybe even next year. Why is it taking so long for them to fix the problems?
Yeah, I don't think any of us saw it lasting this long. I remember you and I talking about this back then, and you know, I kind of thought, well, the most optimistic scenario, the idea that it might just be weeks, was fanciful. But yeah, late summer or something like that. Look, there was a new problem in late June. That's one big issue. Apparently, a microprocessor that could fail. Not part of exactly the same original issue. I mean, it had to do with the pitch, the nose going down, but a new issue where FAA test pilots couldn't easily overcome it and basically said, hey, Boeing, you got to go back and fix this. And so Boeing kind of lost any kind of visibility in terms of guessing exactly when this could go. The planes could be back up in the air, and you have airlines now, yeah, canceling flights into November. And these airlines, you know, if anything, that's conservative. They don't like to cancel and then have to reschedule flights. So that doesn't mean they are sure the planes will be back up in the air in November. It means they feel comfortable that they'll be grounded until at least about then.
So what is it doing to the airlines that relied on the 737 MAX? I saw last week that Delta came out with its earnings. They didn't have any MAXs, and they're actually benefiting from the fact that they didn't have any MAXs.
Yeah, Delta very fortunate to be alone among the big four U.S. airlines. American, Southwest, and United all have that MAX exposure. So they've all had to cancel some flights. That means a little more business for Delta and just far less disruption for Delta. And the problem for airlines around the world, Jeremy, actually grows by the day, because don't forget, you know, that nearly 400 MAXs. There's nearly 400 MAXs that were grounded back in March. Well, Boeing by now would have hoped to deliver another couple hundred MAXs. Airlines were counting on those to be flying by now. So the disruption actually grows because of that.
That's Seth Kaplan, Here and Now transportation analyst. Seth, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
The Emmy nominations are out, and the final season of the HBO series Game of Thrones picked up the most nods, 32, including Best Drama Series. But challenging the HBO behemoth is Bodyguard, the first show from the BBC to be nominated for an Outstanding Drama Series Emmy since 1972. Netflix distributes that show in the U.S. Bodyguard stars Richard Madden as Sergeant David Budd, a police officer who stops a terrorist attack and is assigned to protect the UK's Home Secretary.
I was in Afghanistan. Some mates get killed, nearly got killed myself for what? Nothing. Politicians, cowards and liars, ours and theirs. People full of talk that will never spill a drop of their own blood, but you and I, we're just collateral damage.
Madden won a Golden Globe for his role on the show earlier this year, and prior to Bodyguard, he was best known for playing Robb Stark in Game of Thrones. I spoke with Richard Madden last December, and I asked him what attracted him to his role in Bodyguard.
I think what really got me going was the kind of ambiguity of all the characters. They all live in such a grey zone of what's good and what's bad about each of them, and the script kind of plays with that idea throughout it, and that was something that was really exciting to me. I found them all very human, and their motives and their motives changing throughout the show. I think that was all really exciting, and it was kind of it was a brilliant read, and that's what really drew me in.
Because your character in particular, you're a hero, but at the same time you're doing a lot of things that maybe you shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, he's a hero, and he's a villain, and he's damaged, and he's really strong, and he's a protector, and he's a victim. You know, all these kind of these brilliant contrasting things.
Well, and one of the things that this show gets into, which is very topical right now, is the idea of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, which is something that your character suffers from after time serving in Afghanistan. I want to listen to a scene from the first episode when your character meets up with an old war buddy who wants him to join a veterans support group.
Yes.
Always wondered if you'd turn up sometime.
Soapbox is not really my thing, mate.
That's not how you are in Hellman.
Yeah, it was a crazy time out there. Try to put all that behind me. You know, I'm making a proper go of Civvy Street.
Put PTSD on your job application, who's going to hire you? Right? Just because it's not visible.
So as you were preparing for this role, did you meet with people who have PTSD?
Yeah, I did. I spoke to some people. One of the main problems with with talking to people about PTSD is people don't want to talk about it. The character David Budd, he's in denial about what his situation is and how that affects him and how bad it is for him, which is not as simple as we see in the movies sometimes. This, you know, someone drops a glass and they dive for cover and have mad flashbacks.
Right.
I mean, that can be an element of it, but I think there's a lot more subtleties and a lot more constant living with this disorder that's that was more important for me to bring out and show those subtleties and how people actually carry something all day, every day with them.
So as an actor, how do you do that? How do you express the tension between those multiple layers of emotion?
I don't know. That's a very good, very difficult question to answer. I'm not really quite sure how I did it. I think it was just trying to build this character and build that into him. You know, this denial of it, but this kind of constant bursting out of it at points, which is particularly difficult for a man who's a protector and trying to kind of very much look after everyone else and not taking care of himself.
I want to listen to another clip from the first episode. Your character's boss and also lover at some point is the UK's Home Secretary, who's played by Keely Hawes. She expresses some hawkish views on the Middle East during a TV interview at the BBC. Mm-hmm. And later, your character confronts her about it. Here it is.
May I ask, ma'am, that interview you did on telly, did you mean what you said?
I'm sorry.
About the Middle East.
See, I don't only say what the people want to hear. I'm about doing the right thing and making the hard choices. The thing is, David/Dave, I don't need you to vote for me, only to protect me.
Rest assured, Mum, I'll do what's required.
You know, Richard Madden, as I was watching that, I was thinking to myself, I wonder if this could have even aired or would have even aired 10 years ago, like right after the Iraq War. This is such a feeling that a lot of people are thinking now about the sort of hawkish nature of a lot of governments in this world.
I think that was just a really interesting part of the story there, where he's kind of, he can't help himself. All these things that are built up inside him are kind of bursting out. And you know, he very much oversteps the line in having that conversation with her because he can't help it. He's got a lot of rage and anger at the system and at these people that put him in that position.
What is it like to do a show like this where there are, in this case, 6 episodes and that's it for the moment?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's brilliant. I love this kind of contained element of it. It really means as an actor, I can throw myself in and very much did for a kind of 5-month shoot, which is very grueling and intense. And it, you know, if it was to be like some other show formats and 13 episodes and a kind of 9-month shoot, I'm not sure how well that would go. I loved the intensity of it and this kind of really fast-paced, you know, high-octane drama that we managed to get with the kind of contained 6 episodes.
How does it compare with Game of Thrones?
Very different. I mean, very different because in Game of Thrones it's such a huge ensemble, but Bodyguard is very much cameras kind of just on my character a lot of the time. So that kind of brings a different weight and responsibility, which, I mean, I very much enjoyed.
Do people still stop you on the street and talk to you about being Robb Stark? I mean, has this show and its success sort of overtaken that for you?
Absolutely. People still talk to me about Robb Stark, which I love because it was a character very close to my heart. And it's just, I mean, I'm really thankful I've had the opportunity to play David Budd and be in Bodyguard, and that's, you know, something else, so that I'm not kind of purely defined by just one show, which is really exciting for me. I've kind of tried my best since I left that show to be diverse and try different roles and different things, so I'm really glad that something like Bodyguard has done so well and travelled so well, so, you know, I'm not just typecast, I suppose, as this young prince or king. I can do other things, and it's been nice to be able to express that.
Prince or king who died so gruesomely in the Red Wedding. Are you like afraid to go to weddings now, you know, because you never know what will happen?
No, not at all. Not at all. I think that's a very different world, actually.
Right. So I was reading an interview that you did with the Sun newspaper, and you said that you got into acting because you were shy and overweight as a teenager, or that was part of the reason.
I wasn't overweight at that time. I was very shy. I was a very shy kid, and I got into acting to maybe into a youth theatre to try and combat that and give me a bit of confidence before I went to high school. And that's really where my kind of acting career started. I got a film when I was 11, and then a TV show for a few years, which took me out of school, and it kind of rolled on from there.
And what's been the toughest moment for you over the years?
The toughest moment. I mean,
it can be a tough career, right? You're always auditioning.
It can be a tough career. I think I did a good. Actually, I've been doing a lot of theatre for many years, and very much wanted to get into to camera acting and more television and film stuff. And I think in the UK, it can be very much one or the other when you're starting out. You can only be in one of the circles a lot of the time. And I made a deliberate effort to stop theatre for a while and focus on trying to get camera work. And actually, I was out of work for about 10 months. And had very little money. Actually, my last money I'd spent on my rent, and I was going to have to go back and move in with my parents. And that was a really tough, depressing time. And then right at the end of that 10 months, I got cast in this show called Game of Thrones. That changed the game for me a bit. So one of the best things that happened in my life came out of one of these darkest moments.
And do you still watch Game of Thrones, even though you're dead on the show?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I love it. I watch it as soon as it's out, yeah.
They don't give you the script beforehand to tell you what's going to happen?
No, thankfully they don't anymore. That's one of the joys of being dead now, is that I can just see what happens each season, and I don't know what's going to happen next. And luckily my friends, they know to not tell me anything. Not that they would anyway, because HBO would kill them, but to not tell me what's going to happen. And I can just be a viewer now, which is a really great thing.
That is Richard Madden, who stars in the Netflix show Bodyguard. He was also Robb Stark in Game of Thrones, but check out Bodyguard if you haven't already. Richard Madden, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And obviously, Richard Madden spoke with me last December before Game of Thrones ended. His show Bodyguard is up for an Emmy for Best Drama Series. The Emmys are September 22nd.
We want to spend a few minutes now remembering John Paul Stevens, the former Supreme Court justice who died yesterday at 99, the third longest-serving justice on the court when he retired in 2010, nominated by Republican President Gerald Ford, joining the court in 1975. Stevens wrote opinions in some of the court's landmark cases, including the death penalty, criminal law, and civil liberties. And he stayed active in public life after he left the bench, writing books, doing interviews. Emily Bazelon is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, a fellow at Yale Law School. She joins us now. And Emily, first, your thoughts on John Paul Stevens' passing and his significance on the court.
I mean, it's just such a landmark because we are so unlikely to see another Republican appointee like Justice Stevens again. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that he was not chosen for his ideological predilections. He was chosen as an antitrust lawyer who seemed like a pragmatist to President Gerald Ford.
Well, you know, what would you say to those Republicans are on the right now saying, well, this was actually just a justice who betrayed us, you know, because you write that the fact that he was praised by the Republican who appointed him and a Democrat, Barack Obama, says more about the distance to the right that the party, the Republican Party, moved than his shift to the left. Do you disagree with those who say he just ran to the left?
I don't think he ran to the left. I think he certainly moved toward more liberal positions. There's a pattern of this among Supreme Court justices, and you can say that it's a betrayal of their conservative roots, or you could also imagine that there's something about the experience of being on the court and digging deeply into these very divisive cases that makes people more prone to seeing the Constitution as a living document that changes over time, and that these more wooden interpretation of the Constitution based on what it meant when it was written in the 18th century just becomes unsatisfying. And I think that was certainly what Justice Stevens felt. He was someone who very much believed at looking at the impact of court decision on real people's lives.
Well, you wrote in your recent review of his latest book, The Making of a Justice, Reflections on My First 94 Years, that he was the last of a group of Republican appointees who breathed compassion into the law, put the impact of their decisions on real people above arid theories.
Yeah, so one example of that is the death penalty. When Justice Stevens joined the court in the mid-1970s, the court had really to try to figure out whether to allow the death penalty to continue in America. And Justice Stevens was someone who wrestled with that question. At that point, he said, yes, there is a place for this ultimate penalty in our law and in our Constitution. And then he watched over many years how the death penalty was actually applied. And he got very concerned about how arbitrary and unfair and racially discriminatory it could be. And he changed his mind.
Yeah.
And that kind of willingness to look at evidence, that is what seems rare to us now.
In fact, he called that, if I've got this right, the only regret of his Supreme Court career. But he also called Bush v. Gore. This is the case that settled the election in George Bush's favor, and the Citizens United decisions on campaign financing, two of the court's biggest mistakes.
That's right. Stevens was in dissent on both of those decisions. He worried a great deal that because they seemed like nakedly political decisions, he didn't see them as necessary, that they were going to hurt the court as an institution and also hurt the country. He wanted the justices to, whenever possible, rise above politics. And he did not think that was what they were doing in deciding an election, you know, intervening in an election in which it wasn't really clear to him that the Supreme Court should have a role. And then in Citizens United, you see them opening the floodgates of campaign contributions from corporations and unions. And he thought that was a big mistake.
Yeah. We know that, though, 99, he'd been speaking to people recently. You know, very cogent, very, you know, giving interviews. Do we know how he felt about recent Republican appointees?
He was concerned about how politicized Brett Kavanaugh's nomination became and about how intemperate he saw some of Kavanaugh's statements. He made that clear. And then when he was criticized for getting involved in that process, he kind of backed away from it. So I think he had very keen opinions and a kind of sense of history about the court's evolution. And there were aspects of the court's legacy he wanted to be deeply protective of. He was a committed institutionalist.
And just, Emily, I'm reaching here. I don't know. If you, I mean, had you spent time with him? What was he like as a person?
He was an incredibly engaging, lovely man. I called him a few years ago because I was writing a piece about judges who make mistakes, who look back and imagine that they regret a decision they've made. That's not a subject a lot of judges want to talk a whole lot about because they'd rather see themselves as infallible, right? But Justice Stevens was happy to get on the phone with me and explain to me how his thinking about the death penalty had evolved, how he also regretted a decision he'd made upholding a voter identification law in Indiana. And again, the difference to him was he thought in retrospect that the evidence was clear that those kinds of laws can make it harder for people to vote in a way he didn't understand at the time. He was very driven by evidence.
Of course, he took your call. Justice John Paul Stevens, again, died at 99. Emily Bazelon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, fellow at Yale Law School, remembering him. Emily, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.